we're going to talk about baseball and nothing but baseball for the next hour or thereabouts. And in that, hopefully we can help you guys with an hour of something to think about things other than what you're probably thinking about. And so we welcome you into the 90th episode of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, recording on this Wednesday, November 9th, 2016. I'm Tyler Mon.
And I'm Anthony Masterson.
And hey, buddy.
Yeah, hi. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
We have both been having baseball adventures around the globe.
Yeah, let's talk about yours first. Fire away.
I was basically on the road for pretty much all of the final 3 weeks of October, covering the LCS in Chicago, but not in LA, oddly enough. And then the World Series, Indians and Cubs. And I grew up an Indians fan. My mom's from Cleveland. And so it was very exciting to see that. And it was very, very heartbreaking to see them blow a 3-1 lead, especially at home. It was super heartbreaking.
Detached from it, too, because you're there for work. That sucks.
That's the thing. Like, it's, yeah, of course, everyone's saying, appreciate the moment, appreciate the moment. Yeah, that's going to come later. You got to give me this at this point, because for my job, especially as like a numbers person, like I work in reality. And so like you cannot let your fandom in. You have to give good numbers that make the Cubs look good too, or make the Indians look bad. You can't just be one-sided. And to have to detach myself from that, from a chance to see a World Series, because that's like the one thing as a fan I've always wanted and never got. Like, yeah, like, I'm a big Broncos fan, Super Bowls. I love it. I had so much fun this year. 97, 98, like the Avs, big Avs fan, you know, a 96 and 01, awesome years. Like, I'm a baseball person first and foremost, and, you know, until my dying day, I'm a baseball person. I've always wondered what it would be like to win a World Series with the team that I root for. And so far in my life, I'm 0-4 with the Indians and the Rockies. So it is, it was really cool, obviously, from a macro perspective, to be there for the Cubs winning the World Series for the first time since 1908, blah, blah, blah. It was absolutely gut-wrenching to be there as a fan, but also having to to work and detach yourself. Because even especially just working in sports television, whatever you do in sports, you have to disassociate yourself from your fan self. Unless you work for the team, and that's a little bit different. Like, I work for a network, I have to be able to be as neutral as possible when it comes to my job. I can't be there hooting and hollering and screaming and yelling at Jake Arrieta for being such an asshole. Like, when he's in warming up in the bullpen right below me, I can't be doing that there. I can't, I'm carrying the Fox badge at that point too. We're representing basically for all anybody cares, if something goes wrong and I'm a part of it, people might as well assume I'm representing Rupert Murdoch. You know, that's the kind of thing. So to be on your best behavior, and if you guys know me, if anybody knows me, they know that I am rarely on my best behavior when I'm watching sports. So to have to do that was really, really, really more difficult than I could have possibly imagined it being.
Yeah, not great, Bob.
No.
Not great, Bob.
No, not great. It was, it was great to see the Indians had a great run. You know, they ran out of steam with one pitcher, you know, for the entire playoff run that they had. And, you know, it caught up to them eventually. Obviously, it sucks, but, you know, they should be back.
Let me ask you this question. Because I, you know, like, it's to pull back the curtain, it's the day after the election, obviously. And so, like, I and, you know, everyone I know is abjectly miserable. And tonight I went out to dinner with some family and my sister just ended up furious with me because between, you know, all of that stuff yesterday and just other shit in life, like I was miserable today. Today was just a miserable day. And so I go out to dinner with my family. I sit there. I don't talk much. I was technically logged in for work. So I'm like messaging back and forth with somebody that I'm working with. And so then I get like this laundry list of text messages from my sister about like, you need to be able to compartmentalize those things and be, you know, when you're not happy, everybody around you feels that, and that's just your type of personality. Then everybody's all bummed out that you're not happy. I can't do that, though. And with sports, it's the same way. Like, when my teams go out and they play like garbage, I carry that around with me. Like, I feel that stuff so internally. Can you, like, when the Rockies lost in 07, even now, thinking back to 2007, yeah, the run to get to the playoffs was great.
21-63
was great.
Awesome.
That was all great. But when I think back to 2007, I think about watching the last out on the warning track and the fly ball off the bat of Jamie Carroll and turning around and walking out of Coors Field because I didn't want to watch another team celebrate on that field. Like, I don't remember. I remember how good things felt, but the overlying, overarching thing to me is they still didn't win a ring. You know, like, no. That's how I am. And so then to be told, like, oh, well, appreciate the moment the Indians were in the World Series, who gives a shit?
Yeah,
if it all ends depressingly, how does anybody not let that sink them? I don't know. Like, I'm obviously just in a garbage mood, but, like,
sure.
It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's been a really bad week for liberal Indians fans, like myself. It's been a rough go of it, basically. But you also had a very cool baseball thing happen to you over the last few weeks.
Yeah,
talk about that.
As of like 2 days ago, life was as good as it had been for me in like 5 years. It was great. It was great. And then here we find ourselves. I went to Arizona for the Arizona Fall League. I was there for a few days a couple of weeks ago, and then I was off to Monterrey and Saltillo, Mexico for the World Baseball Softball Confederation's U23 Baseball World Cup. WBSC, in case you are unfamiliar.
That sounds like a mouthful. Yeah,
it's the FIFA of baseball. It used to be called the International Baseball Federation, and then in the push to get baseball and softball back in the Olympics, which has since been successful for 2020 in Tokyo, they merged baseball and softball as one male and female bat and ball sport. And so that was the push to get it back in the Olympics. So they united the two governing bodies. So IBAF became the WBSC. So that is the overarching governing body for baseball. So that is, you know, when you look at the U15 or U18 or U23 World Cups, that's the organization that puts it on. So went down to Saltillo and to Monterrey, did 10 days worth of doubleheaders over 12 days, so like 20 games, which was nuts, but a ton of fun. USA Baseball did not send a team, and the reason that I heard USA Baseball from its age groups, there's U12, U15, U18, and then the next age group between U18 and the senior men's national team, and I think on the USA Baseball side is actually 18U, but whatever. It's the collegiate national team is the one in between those. And so from what I had heard, they couldn't get NCAA clearance to bring the collegiate national team for a tournament like that, which makes sense. It's a fall semester.
Yeah,
it's the middle of classes. It makes sense. But there were still a pretty good amount of decent prospects down there. The Rockies had one prospect, Robbie Perkins, a catcher who was with Modesto for part of last season. He was on the Australian team. And, you know, so it was good to see some of the upcoming talent in minor league baseball. What was even cooler to see from my perspective was the Japanese national team, the Korean national team, Chinese Taipei. They brought over their major leaguers, basically, their youngest guys in Nippon Professional Baseball and the Korea Baseball Organization in the Chinese Professional Baseball League. And so that was really neat. I mean, seeing, you know, the kind of 1A and 1B major leagues in NPB and KBO.
It was like Shohei Ohtani there and everything?
No, which would have been awesome. But he was pitching in the Japan series. They won the Hokkaido Nippon Ham Fighters, and he set a new pitch speed record in the Japan series, which I think is like the 16th time that he's broken the speed record this year alone. But yeah, no, I mean, there were some Yusuke Masago, who's kind of an up-and-comer in Japan, was the cleanup guy. He was the tournament MVP. There are some really, really fun prospects on those teams. And so that was really cool. And yeah, that wrapped up on Sunday and came back here on Monday, and Tuesday the world ended. So it was good. I had a good run. I had a good run to the end of it.
Yeah, you really did.
But yeah, so we've been
You weren't just playing out the string.
No, I was going hard to the finish. But we've been out with this podcast since the beginning of October, and October 6th with our last episode, and that episode covered kind of the same issue that we're going to talk about in this episode, which is the Colorado Rockies managerial situation. Walt Weiss wrapping his three-year tenure up at the end of the regular season in 2016. Bud Black is the new man at the helm for the Colorado Rockies. And before we dive too far into it, I just want initial reacts. Bud Black, he was a guy who we had talked about as far back as last year as a potential managerial candidate if the Rockies decided not to bring Walt Weiss back for 2016. Bud Black, a lot of ties to the Denver area and to Colorado, managed here as the longtime manager of the San Diego Padres, and now, you know, former major leaguer, former guy who's pitched in the World Series, a guy who knows what it takes to be a part of a team that can play at a championship level. And I think an underrated manager during his time at San Diego. But your thoughts on Bud Black?
I really think that we've been talking about Bud Black as a Rockies manager for like 6 years now.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
Yeah, that does seem about right.
I mean, so even when he was in San Diego, San Diego, we're like, oh, well, you know, Bud Black, like, he'd be a great fit here in Denver and yada, yada, yada. I'd say, well, because he's a pitcher's manager, or is a former pitcher, and you don't see a lot of former pitchers necessarily as managers, which I found interesting. But you don't see a lot of those guys at running the show, because usually it's catchers, fielders, you know, whomever. Yeah, that was always one of Pete Rose's big things, that you rarely saw a former pitcher who became a manager, because they don't make good managers, according to Pete Rose. Bud Black, he really did a yeoman's effort in San Diego. With a lot of bad teams, he made them competitive basically because of their team pitching staff. Usually some of the worst offenses in baseball, but the pitching staff, thanks to Petco Park, of course, thanks to the Marine Layer, would keep them in a lot of ball games, give them one of the lower ERAs in the league. But I think one of the quotes that really stuck with me, I think Troy Rank might have even reported this, oddly enough, when it all went down, even though he's not really on the Rockies beat anymore, was that he interviewed a couple of Rockies players, and they said, as an organization, that the players didn't want another first-year manager in the clubhouse, especially when they see themselves on the precipice of what could be a very, very good season next year. They have a loaded roster, a lot of talent, especially in the pitching department as well, better than they might have ever had. And they did not want a first-year guy taking over the reins when they're so close to coming back to contention. And I thought that was really, really interesting, because a lot of the names being bandied about was, like, you know, Dave Martinez, the Cubs bench coach. He was a big one. But then you had your old retreads like Ron Renicky, Bud Black can kind of fall into that mold as well. But I think the players themselves, who are there and going to be there next year, I think they realize that they really do need a true leader, but not one who's just going to be learning the ropes and learning everything about Coors Field, you know, as the season progresses. They want to be able to start on April 3rd and be ready to go and have a manager who knows what it takes to win at Coors Field, knows what it takes to play at Coors Field, knows the challenges presented to him, like Bud Black does, who's the Padres from 2007 to 2015. He knows Coors Field. And I thought that was the best part of it for me, was that quote there. And that's why I think Bud Black was a really smart choice for this team as it stands right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you bring up a good point. What is among the most exciting things about that from the Rockies' perspective is I think Rockies players are excited about this because of the fact that this is a guy who is not entering his first rodeo. And that was, you know, I mean, you talk about somebody like Dave Martinez, and, you know, I know you retweeted it from the PDP account. It was an angle that we didn't really think about quite as much going into this search, in that the Rockies and Rockies players right now know how close they are. So do you want to risk, I don't want to say wasting, do you want to risk waging a hire on a first-time manager, handing him a roster that is extraordinarily talented, and then letting him learn on the job? You know, because that seems risky. The windows of contention are so sporadic. They're so few and far between for the Rockies, and they can be so small that in 2017, if things are primed as they seem to be for this team to really break out, does that feel like a detriment? And I think it would. And so I think that's a big thing with the Rockies, is that you get a guy who has been in this situation before. He was the 2010 National League Manager of the Year. Not a ton of postseason success in San Diego, but I think Bud Black did a lot more with poorer teams than what he was credited with when he was in San Diego.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of positives in that regard for this team. And, there's a really good story up on the Rockies site that Thomas Harding put together earlier this week when the hire was announced, saying – that was the initial reaction from players, was like, everything I've heard about him from the end of the year, or throughout my time in baseball, when we got to the end of the year and Walt was gone, you know, this is a guy that I was really excited about. Now I'm really excited to have him here. Like, that kind of stuff is really positive.
Yeah, because if you get a guy and a first-year manager and he's not good and he can't communicate with players and he gets terrified by Coors Field or for whatever reason, then you could set back your organization a couple of years. And obviously managers don't control everything when it comes to how a team does at the end of the year. But I mean, as we saw in the postseason this year, a lot of moves that Joe Maddon made, a lot of moves Terry Francona made, they really could have shifted the power one way or the other. Even when they made seemingly terrible moves, it worked out in some way or the other. So, I think what the Rockies need is to be able to have a manager who knows how to work a bullpen. And I believe that Bud Black is that guy. He's got a lot of experience. And that's why people were kind of poo-pooing it, like, oh, well, he wasn't that great in San Diego, blah, blah, blah. But I think it'd be a mistake to call this a bad hire, because, yes, it was safe, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And there's a huge distinction there. Sure, it might have been a safe hire, but it's not a dumb hire.
Right.
And I think that's the first time that we can say that about a Rockies manager in quite some time, because, I'm not sure if Black has any high school baseball coaching experience, but he's definitely done it at the big league level before. The most important thing is having high school experience at the coaching level. So that's why I think there were issues, clearly, with people saying, oh yeah, well, we wanted somebody new, we wanted somebody who could be an up-and-comer, who, whatever. I think the Bud Black hire is one that I think is a perfect fit, and once I heard the players were really on board with it, because you heard their lukewarm endorsements of Walt Weiss once the season ended. Adam Ottavino saying, "Yeah, well, he's still here, so he's the manager."
Right.
It's like, don't hide your feelings.
It's not
there,
for
Adam.
Me to decide where we go from here, but I'd like to play on a winner, that type of stuff.
Yeah, but to hear the fact that players were really excited about the hire because they know he's a known commodity, he's a smart guy, he actually done a pretty good job of putting in analytics. Even when it was just a burgeoning thing with San Diego, he was actually our manager that we had for our Sabermetrics simulcast that we had for FS1 back, it'll be the 2013 or no, the 2014 LCS, the Giants and Cardinals. He was in the studio with us with like Gabe Kapler and CJ Nitkowski, and we were doing our Sabermetrics simulcast of game one of that LCS, and he was the manager that came in and did a very good job explaining how managers are able to take all the information put in front of them and parlay it to their players, or what they need to be thinking at certain in-game moments. He was a really smart guy, so I think that he knows the challenges presented to him right away, and I think it's going to be a very, very solid hire for the Rocks no matter what.
I do very much like the fact that this is a move that emphasizes pitching and managing the pitching staff, managing a bullpen, and the understanding of what it is going to take to be successful. Because not only is it a guy who was a pitcher, but it is a guy who pitched in big moments in his career, then moved off to be a major league pitching coach after his playing days were over, then was a manager at the most pitching-friendly ballpark in baseball in Petco Park, and simultaneously had to manage a staff that called Petco Park home at Coors Field for 9-10 games a year, and in that sort of figured out what it was going to take to be successful in Colorado. I don't think that those lessons are taken lightly from Bud Black, and that stuff is all extremely positive to me. The other thing that I really like about this hire is the Rockies obviously have retained the services of Steve Foster and Darren Holmes, a pitching coach and bullpen coach, And Bud Black was asked about that as an in his introductory press conference, and he said, not only do I not consider that an issue, but it's something that I've dealt with before, because when I was in San Diego, we had the same situation there. And so that, to me, speaks to a guy who is confident and comfortable in knowing what he is able to do, and I really believe feels like those are two guys who are in the right position. Steve Foster, I mean, you can't look at the Rockies rotation this year and not see market improvement. I mean, especially with John Gray as the year went on. Tyler Anderson was a revelation. Tyler Chatwood, especially on the road, obviously was fantastic. You know, the strides from Chad Bettis at times during the season. The guys who were eventually going to fill that five spot, you know, even the Jeff Hoffman start at the end of the year where he looked really good. Herman Marquez flashed some good stuff. Kyle Freeland is one step below. The starters seem to really be in good hands. The bullpen is going to be a question mark, but I think the fact that Bud Black immediately said, not only is this not an issue to me, I've already dealt with it before, I have a lot of confidence in those guys. I really like that, too. I think that's a really positive sign, knowing that all hands are on deck to get the pitching staff worked out, and they seem to all be capable hands.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And by the way, in that span that Bud Black was coaching the Padres, they had 36 wins at Coors Field. That was their most at any other ballpark besides Petco in that time frame. So,
see, that is pretty impressive.
You know, yeah. You know, it's I think the familiarity that he has with the organization, with the ballpark, with the city of Denver, I think that's going to go a long, long way. He already has legitimacy when it comes to the players in that clubhouse. And it's not, yes, there are young guys in the clubhouse, but there's some veterans too. And to have that guy come in already with a track record instead of a guy like Walt Weiss, who really, we're not going to belabor the point, but he did really come from high school. That is, he was coaching high school in Denver.
You know, so, and he had been on kind of on major league staffs as a special assistant, et cetera. But yeah, there's nothing.
It's not Weiss's fault.
Right.
Just,
not at all.
Where he was and he was hired. I mean,
and at the same time,
they approached him with it.
Exactly. That was not. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's not something that Walt Weiss sort of got painted into that corner by the fact that they hired him when and how they did. But
right.
Also, you know, you can't replicate major league managerial and coaching staff experience in anything else. You know, which is why we've talked about Pat Murphy. Pat Murphy's a former head coach at Arizona State, went on coaching the Padres organization and is very well regarded, and now is the bench coach in Milwaukee. But even that, it's not like he jumped from Arizona State to a major league job. So that is I think a big thing about this. This is another thing I think really speaks to the maturity of Jeff Breidich, is he didn't go out and make an easy hire, a fan favorite former player, something like that. Jason Giambi wasn't considered for this job. Like, this really does seem like a lot went into this. You know, I mean, I think the Rockies, you probably right now look across the division and you think to yourself, like, well, look at what the D-backs are doing. Like, that reshaping feels like a very full reshaping. And maybe in some ways you kind of wish that had happened in Colorado. But it didn't. And I think Jeff Breidich, through his first 2 years, has made a lot of positive moves. And I think this is the latest one. And to look at, you know, a 9-win improvement, whatever it was, 2015 to 2016, they're obviously headed in the right direction. And another thing that I think speaks very loudly about this move is the way the national media has responded to it, which is, you know, I think there have been a certain subsect of people who don't really pay that much attention to the Rockies and don't know that much about the National League West, who have said, well, this is a non-contending team. Hiring a manager, it's not going to make them a contender. But when you parse out more details, when you look a little bit more between the lines, Richard Justice had a column on MLB.com saying that this is basically the perfect possible hire the Rockies could have made, because so much of their talent is so good and so young, and now you're bringing in a guy who has a ton of experience and figuring out what it takes to be a winner. So you're not entrusting your most talented roster in 6 or 7 years,
you might have ever had.
Right, exactly, if not in franchise history, to somebody who's going to be working it out on the job first day. That, I think, is a big thing. You're giving the keys to a sports car to a race car driver. You're not giving them to a kid who just turned 16.
Yeah, we'll obviously see what they do in the off season. But yeah, I think it was a very, very good hire, and I think we can leave it at that and move on.
All right, let's move on then. Yesterday,
let's move on then.
Came some pretty big news for Colorado Rockies fans. Quote, No third baseman in history has gloved as much gold as quickly as the Rockies' Nolan Arenado, Thomas Harding says at MLB.com. Arenado on Tuesday became the first third baseman in history and the first National Leaguer at any position to earn Rawlings Gold Glove Awards in his first four seasons in the majors. He's the first third baseman to win four straight gold gloves at all since Scott Rolen had a five-year run, and he joined outfielder Ichiro Suzuki as the only players to win the award in each of their first four seasons. Ichiro's run lasted 10 years, by the way, which is ridiculous. But yeah, this is so cool, and congratulations to Nolan. It's I don't even know what more we can really say on this topic. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I mean, actually, if you look at full seasons, not just the first season, but full seasons when they exceeded their rookie limits, only four guys have done what Nolan Arenado has done. It's Arenado, Charles Johnson, oddly enough, from 95 to 98, he had four consecutive.
Yeah, that was really
four
surprising.
Seasons.
You kind of forget and how then, good he was.
And Ichiro and Johnny Bench each did it in 10 consecutive years in their first 10 full seasons in the big leagues. But you're right. Arenado and Ichiro are the only two who have done it in their first four seasons in general. Like when they make their major league debut, the next four seasons, that's it. Pretty wild.
That's crazy. It's,
yeah.
It's crazy.
It's coming to a point where you don't know what even to say about Nolan Arenado anymore. It's
yeah.
Because you've run out of superlatives, and you got to start making words up, I think.
Yeah, basically. Well, they have the Nolan generator. The Rockies do.
That's true. I mean, well, do you rename the award after Nolan Arenado next
could
year?
Eventually.
Are we to that point yet?
Yeah.
Are we to that point yet?
I mean, at five in a row to start a career, you could probably just call it the Rawlings Nolan Arenado Award. The
like
Golden
the,
Nolan
just
Award.
Just the third baseman award. Like, it could be named the Adrian Beltre Award in the American League.
Yeah, that'd be
and
cool.
The Nolan Arenado Award in the National League.
This is what's so crazy. Nolan is four seasons into his major league career. He already has the second most gold gloves in Rockies history. He tied Todd Helton with that. Larry Walker had five. Nolan is four seasons into his major league career, and he's already got the second most. Like, at this rate, Nolan's going to win 15 gold gloves easily. You know? I just
yeah.
don't. Like, at some point, you figure somebody will have some crazy good year. But Nolan is
yeah.
Nolan turned 25 in April, and he's got four gold gloves.
And his defensive run saved among NL third baseman, he had 20, which is one of the highest marks of any position in all the sport. The next closest NL third baseman was Anthony Rendon, who had eight. And oh, by the way, he's raised his OPS each of his four seasons in the big leagues. He's hit 40 home runs in back-to-back years. He's driven 130 in back-to-back years. OPS of 932 this past year. I mean, he is a star, and he is going to take the Rockies to the promised land in a way that really no other singular player, I don't think, has before in Rockies history. There's an argument to be made for a lot of players, Todd Helton, of course, but even when the Rockies kind of made their runs, it was more at the end of his career. They had, of course, the Blake Street Bombers, but they were more of a unit. They had, Andres and Nellis and Walker and Bichette, Castilla. But even with the two lone holiday years, it was always kind of when one picked up when one was struggling, the other picked up the slack. I think Nolan Arenado, he is broken onto the national scene, at least among people who know baseball. I think more than any other of those players did prior to making the postseason. Obviously, when you're on the postseason stage, you get national attention like the Rockies did in 07 or in 09. But I think he's so good that he is completely permeated the national media when it comes to naming some of the best players in all of baseball. I think that's a very, very rare thing that's happened in Rockies history, really. I mean, do you think that's the way is all? Because I'm trying to figure out another guy who's really done so without having ever made a playoff appearance for the Rockies, and I don't think that's the case at all.
No, and Nolan, I think, has also created a larger profile for himself on the national stage than any non-contending team Rockies player ever. Because, Larry Walker was a star before he came to Colorado. Todd Helton would be the only other one who comes into that conversation.
When Todd Helton almost hit when he was hitting 400 in August.
Right, in his third full professional season, or his third full major league season.
That was the closest.
Full major league season. Yeah, that was it. I mean, other than him, you really can't look at anybody else because Matt Holliday broke in 2004. And 2005 was kind of the anchor of that really young team when they were sort of in contention in 2006. And then 2007, he leads them to the World Series, should have been the MVP that year. You know, and even the other guys on that team who you thought were going to be stars for a long time, you know, the Garrett Atkinses and the Brad Hopps.
Yeah.
Those guys, I think, were lifted by the rising tide of the Rockies being in contention. Nolan is in the conversation as the best players in baseball on teams that have been total non-factors, with the exception of that one stretch this summer throughout his career. And that's pretty damn impressive.
Yeah, he's basically Mike Trout the last couple of years. I mean, that's kind of what it is. Like, you look at some of the best players on bad teams.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Nolan Arenado is... and Mike Trout right now are on the tops of that list. I gotta say, I mean, you're in the same stratosphere even in that respect, because your defense is so good, your offense is so good, and people realize that it's not just Coors with Nolan Arenado, and that's the big thing too. I think the defense helps. It helps you get a national consciousness, because, you know, they see you on Baseball Tonight, you got web gems or whatever. You see another crazy play by Nolan Arenado.
Right.
Oh, he had a home run in that game too. Oh, crazy! Wow, he's really good. And you start to perk up a little bit. And I think that what's really helped Nolan Arenado, besides the defense and everything with the highlights you can see, is that the Gold Glove started using advanced metrics to award themselves
right.
the year that he came into the league in 2013.
Right.
Because otherwise, no one's going to give a random rookie third baseman from a bad team in Colorado a Gold Glove based on the old standards, because they just handed those out to anybody who was a very popular player who they saw, like, make a web gem once throughout the summer.
Remember that year?
Tonight.
Wasn't it Rafael Palmeiro won a Gold Glove while playing like 12 games at first base?
Yeah. 9 games at first. Yeah. Or like, you know,
what an award.
The O-Dog or Orlando Hudson. Like,
Yeah.
Won it over Jamie Carroll. Carroll didn't commit an error the entire season. Hudson had like 20 and he won the Gold Glove. It's like, okay, well, that doesn't make any sense. But
the vote process, by the way, according to Thomas Harding, our good pal at Rockies.com, quote, managers and coaches for each club voted for players in their league but were not allowed to vote for players on their team to account for 75% of the selection process. The Society for American Baseball Research applies the Sabre Defensive Index for the other 25%. So that is a very adaptable award to a modern baseball time, and that's really cool.
Right. Yeah, it is, and you can kind of see – the FanGraphs leaders in defensive runs saved, like, go just to that top of that list, and you're going to see a lot of guys who want a Gold Glove this year, and really over the last few years. So I think that really, really helps Nolan Arenado raise his Q rating nationally. And if the Rockies take the next step this year and they're in contention well into the deep summer months, you're going to start talk of Nolan Arenado as the best player and one of the best players in baseball, if it's not there already. Obviously, you got Mike Trout. You know, Harper had a down year, so he's a little bit out. You know, Donaldson, Machado, you know, whether it's the next shortstop Breed, Correa, Lindor. But Arenado is going to be there if he's not already. I think you ask anybody who knows the game of baseball, even right now, he's in the top 10. And in some circles, probably a top 5 all-around player. So it's going to take the Rockies getting to a point where they are making themselves known to the rest of the league and to the rest of the country, and not just some crazy run at the end of a season, but to be good from April to September. That's going to, if they do that next year, Nolan Arenado is going to be a household name in America.
Which the fact that he isn't already is just kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is what it is, you know?
Yeah. You know, that is where we find ourselves with, Nolan, who is among the coolest human beings ever, and was once on this podcast, by the way. Remember when we had Nolan on?
Yes, he was.
Remember Nolan? Remember Nolan being
God,
on the show?
What the hell happened to us?
So much more innocent time back then. We were all young and free. The Rockies have a few spots that really need addressing going into 2017, but really not many of them, and that is a very encouraging thing. Everywhere on the diamond is settled, with the exception of the bullpen and first base. Now, Rockies general manager Jeff Breidich, at the GM meetings in Scottsdale, Arizona, told Rockies.com's Thomas Harding again that the Rockies will be looking to add an impactful bat at first base if possible. Quote, that's certainly on our mind, unquote. And also that the bullpen is obviously very much an issue. The Rockies had the worst bullpen ERA in baseball in 2016. And he said, did Breidich quote, how can we upgrade the bullpen? I don't think it's going to be a bullpen overhaul in our future, but we're going to be strategic. I was on with Nate Kreckman the other day on Altitude 950 in Denver, and Nate had a very good point that I think you would be very good to address, which is the Rockies had so many guys fall apart at the same time this year that there almost seems to be, instead of a regression to the mean, there almost seems going into 2017 that you have to eyeball a progression to the mean. There have to, you can't look at the bullpen in 2017.
You can't suck that badly
exactly
for that long the exact same way.
All at the exact same time. Like, you can't look at Jake McGee and Chad Qualls and Jason Mott and even Adam Ottavino when he struggled at times. And Adam's obviously a much different circumstance because trying to get himself figured out after Tommy John surgery, you're going to be markedly better your first full year back than when you're coming right off of rehab and all that kind of stuff. But all those guys, Miguel Castro's struggles, Carlos Estevez's struggles, all those guys, it seems like when things went wrong, they all went wrong simultaneously. So it does have to feel to a certain extent like the Rockies have to bank a little bit on guys getting better. Now, that's not going to preclude them from going out and getting more talent to add to that bullpen, but don't you think in some circles that's probably the case, that you have to look at what happened in 2016 and think, all right, the odds that happens again are pretty slim?
I mean, the Rockies had 23 different players on the DL last year. That was for second most in all of baseball. So
only behind the Dodgers, who set a major league record.
Yes, with 28. So they did this last year when they signed Jason Mott and they signed Chad Qualls. They thought those would be veteran guys who have had success consistently in the big leagues. They would come in, do their job. Whether, you know, they would obviously have a little worse numbers because everyone has worse numbers than they get to Colorado. But they thought guys that they've been around, they know the drill, they'd be able to calm any young bullpen arms nerves that they had, because these guys have won World Series before. You know, they've pitched in huge games and it didn't work. They got hurt, they were ineffective, and it kind of set a poor tone for the rest of the bullpen the rest of the year, because those were two guys that you got in free agency, you paid multiple millions of dollars to come in and settle the bullpen situation, and then they did not get the job done. So I think there's a lot of truth to that, where you get to a certain point and it's hard for this team to suck in the same ways for so long with the same guys. It's very, very difficult to do the same thing over and over again the exact same way. So we saw this year with the proliferation of relievers, especially in the playoffs. I know the postseason is a much smaller sample size that doesn't really work over a long haul. Like, it'd be tough to do what Terry Francona did with Andrew Miller over the course of a full season. I think that's unrealistic to expect that of one guy to be able to handle that workload, one,
right,
and two, to be okay with that role, especially when it comes to arbitration and you know salary and trying to get a free agent deal and all that stuff. So what you have to do is get a little bit creative if you're a manager, and I think this is where Bud Black is going to come in, because you saw what can work in a playoff situation, in a one game situation. But to be able to do that over the course of a full season, that's where a manager can come in and really make his mark on a team. Because we've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's really tough for a manager day to day to really have an effect more than the bullpen management, lineup construction, and then basically massaging egos and dealing with the media. That's what a manager needs to be really good at. So I'd be fascinated to see what they try to do in the offseason. I can't imagine them trying to go for one of the huge pieces like a Jansen or a Chapman. I think they're going to be pricing themselves out of the Rockies' payroll very, very quickly.
I agree. Although, but could you see them going for somebody like Mark Melancon?
Sure. To be fair, you know,
especially because he's a Denver guy,
it will be a record payroll for the Rockies this year.
Yeah.
So that they will open the purse strings a little bit. I think Mark Melancon would be a great fit. He is a guy who works with a lot of ground balls. He has clearly a lot of Denver ties, so that'd be really cool if I'm just not sure what he would want to take in terms of a deal, because, once the Jansen and Chapman dominoes fall for relievers, Melancon really is going to be – he could be the third best reliever on the market right now. So he may be – he may get overpaid by somebody after someone signs Chapman and Jansen to some ungodly deal. But he would be, I think, a really good fit in Denver. I mean, because even though he keeps getting older, as we all do, as time marches on, he keeps getting better. I mean, it's remarkable what he's done since coming over to the Pirates. I mean, these are his ERAs by year since 2013, 1.39, 1.90, 2.23. And then split between Pittsburgh and Washington this year, 1.64. He keeps the ball on the ground, rarely allows home runs. I mean, yeah, he'd be the exact type of prototype that you'd want for the Rockies. He'd be a veteran to lock down the ninth inning. You have that ready to go when the season starts. Then you can shift everybody else back out of, you know, shift back to the eighth. Then you have any of your young guys if they start to pitch really well. Your Estevez's, your Miguel Castro's pitching the sixth, seventh, the lower leverage innings to get them more comfortable. The Estevez's. You can get them pitching in lower leverage situations initially, even though they've had a year of experience, just to get their confidence up. They didn't really end the season that well last year. Get their confidence up, and then when, you know, injuries inevitably happen, as they always do every year with the Rockies bullpen, you have guys ready to go back and pitch in those later innings because they have the confidence that was given to them early in the year when they were pitching in the sixth and seventh innings instead of, you know, trying to lock down a one-run lead in the ninth inning the first week of the season. If they blow it, then everyone looks at the ERA and says, oh, a 9 ERA for Carlos Estevez. This guy sucks. Get him out of there. He can't pitch the ninth. I think that would loosen up a lot of nervous energy the Rockies fans and the young players may have if they can get a guy like Mark Melanson. I think that's a very, very good fit for the Rockies should they be able to sign him.
Well, and I think one of the really encouraging things is that Jeff Bridich has said pretty consistently that one of the things that they're really excited about going into 2017 is that they do have this payroll flexibility. It's also kind of a slap in the face because, quote, the Rockies won't be unlimited in their spending. It's likely that the team's biggest payroll item will be Mets infielder Jose Reyes, whom the Rockies released last year, unquote, which is kind of a punch in the stomach. But, you know, they do have payroll flexibility. Aside from that deal, there's not anybody on the Rockies right now who's making – roster breaking type of money.
Tulo's money is not Cargo making 20 million this year.
And there are no longer, you know, a couple of years ago, Cargo and Tulo commanded 2/3 of that team's payroll, and that's not the case anymore. So they do have some flexibility.
And with De La Rosa, it was about 75%.
Right.
Yeah, De La Rosa out of that.
So that's good because could the Rockies make a run at somebody like Edwin Encarnacion? Could the Rockies make a run at another power bat that they could put at first base? Today there was discussion that Matt Holliday would be open to coming back to Colorado to play some first base.
Can you imagine
Edwin?
Oh my god, Coors Field.
That'd be so sexy. I would be so turned on by that. He's a DH still, so that's the thing.
But
I hate the parrot. Now, just because he did it against the Rockies this year, but if he came to the Rockies, I would wear a parrot to Coors Field every time I went.
Isn't it funny
just
how
wear
that
my
works.
Own parrot? Yeah. Oh no, that would be so sexy.
Like when Papelbon used to come out to "I'm Shipping Up to Boston" when that song was big, and he was the Red Sox closer. It was like, oh man, that's like so perfect, and Red Sox fans loved him. And then when he came back and pitched for them with the Phillies, and they played his song, everyone booed the living hell out of him. So. Yeah, there are things you put up with when there's a guy on your own team that you wouldn't do it when he's on somebody else.
That's true.
And yeah, then
he's also an incredibly insufferable human being too, Jonathan Papelbon.
Eh, well, but, yeah. Well, I'll do Encarnacion. I was like, definitely Papelbon.
Oh yeah, no, Edwin Encarnacion seems like he would just be a whole pile of fun to have around. So
just hitting dinger.
Yeah, exactly. Just dropping dongs.
Big swinging dongs.
Mashing big swinging dongs all over the place. Sometimes I forget that people don't use the same terms as we do. And the other day when I was in Mexico, I ran into a guy that I knew from when I used to live in Sydney and work for the Australian Baseball League named Jacob Eunice, who's the shortstop on the Aussie team. He plays for the Sydney team in the ABL. He used to play in the Twins system. And he hit a huge homer early on in the tournament. And so when I saw him, I said, Jake, what are you doing out here? Just slapping dongs and flipping bats? And he gave me this look like, what the hell did you just say to me? Because he had a sweet bat flip after the homer, but I guess the term slapping dongs doesn't
it has not gone
not crossing
across
the
equator yet, huh?
Yeah. I guess not.
That's good to know. I was unaware of that fact. I will make sure to put that in my memory bank for future reference.
Now you know. But yeah, so
I really wish like Buck would have busted that out at the World Series, like, you know,
that would have been pretty
Chris
great.
Chris Bryant hits that massive, big swinging donger in Game 6. Like, oh, and Chris Bryant with a big old dong to left.
I would have been so okay with that.
Speaking of dongs and athletes. So
Jason Hayward, am I right?
Yeah, am I right? Baby's arm holding an apple.
oh my God. This is when we finally get our non-explicit credential revoked on iTunes.
You can cut that out. Yeah. I was calling Long Beach State exhibition game against Caltech on Saturday, and they have a guy in their lineup named Andrew Wang.
Okay.
It was fun because in basketball, things are happening so fast, you don't really have time to put emphasis on things like really, really well, like you do in baseball. Like, you don't have time to set up a moment, you know, it's because you got, especially on radio, you have to describe what's happening. Yeah. And so, you know, he's in the game and I see he's in the game and I'm referencing what he's doing. And, you know, I had to keep myself from laughing the entire time I was doing it because I realized what I was saying like 30 seconds after I said it, like, oh, Wang in the lane, runner coming up a little bit short. Like, or like Wang through the legs, going baseline. Oh, rims out. Like,
man. Yeah, no, it happens. It definitely happens. It's you always got to be careful.
So anyway,
the old words. On a different note, but sort of similar, I guess, word wise. So the Rockies hire Bud Black, right?
Right.
Second
Bud manager in history.
Yeah, as Anthony noted, the Rockies are really kind of they're setting a new inefficiency with managers named Bud or Buddy. Bud Black's real name is Harry Ralston Black. But Bud Black's wife is named Nan, N-A-N.
Which, oh, yeah, yeah.
Which really just Bud leads me to feel like the Rockies hired a manager in 1952.
It's like it's such old a quaint
Bud
name.
Nan. I know. It's just like when Bridish said that, like, oh, there's obviously a tremendous amount of respect in baseball for Bud and his wife, Nan. I was like, Bud and Nan? What? Really? They live next door to the Cleavers? What's going on here? So,
oh my God.
So now we have that, everybody. Don't you worry.
Yeah.
Don't you worry.
Yeah. Don't worry, guys. We're on the beat.
It's Trump's America. We're all going back to the 1950s anyway. So,
yeah.
It's, you know, it'll be great.
Might as well hire a guy with the name of Bud.
Hey, Bud. And this is my wife, Nan.
My name's Bud. You can call me Guy, though.
Oh, my God. By the way, according to Purple Row, another thing that I do think is a good key component to the Bud Black era that I forgot to mention earlier, quote, this is the first time since hiring the other one, Buddy Bell, for the 2000 season that the Rockies have brought in a manager with no previous experience in the organization. Breidich said that was not a consideration in the hire, but that he will appreciate another perspective. And that I very much like because for too long, the Rockies were so resistant to anything outside of the organization. I really, really like that.
Yeah, and we'll see what they do in the offseason this year because I really want to see the type of free agents they're trying to go for. Because, yeah, as we mentioned, they really just need bullpen and first base. Those are the big question marks right now because at catcher, you got Tommy Murphy hopefully ready to step up, take that next step. DJ, Story, Arenado, infield, that part of the infield's done. Then Blackman, Cargo, Dahl, got to imagine that's done. You know, that's ready to go. You know, Parr is your fourth outfielder at this point. You know, there's not a lot of gaping holes, I should say. Everyone needs another starting pitcher, sure. But there's not a lot of gaping holes in the lineup right now. So when you don't have a large wish list, I think that's obviously should help the Rockies because usually they've come in the offseason going, well, we need six positions. We need three starting pitchers. We need four bullpen guys. But this year is not that year. And you're starting to see the tide turn and people are saying like, man, this Rockies team really, really is close. The winter meeting is coming up in about a month now. So that's always a fun time, especially the last couple of years, I feel like the winter meetings have just been on steroids, which has been made it a lot of fun, but then the Rockies never end up doing anything. So.
Well, you know, it's always an exciting offseason when you're a Colorado Rockies fan. Winter meetings, by the way, does kind of make me think the other thought about Bud Black that I also forgot to mention. But, you know, we were talking about I feel like he was underrated in San Diego. The other thing about that is, too, he was handed such an impossible situation in 2015 when the new administration came in San Diego, blew up that roster, added a ton of high-priced guys that did not work at all, and then handed this, you know, bizarre sandwich to Bud Black and said, okay, go make this a winner. Like
what, like tripe?
Yeah,
like a
basically.
Tripe sandwich?
It was like a cheeks meat. It's one of those things. But yeah, so I think not only was Bud Black underrated when he was in San Diego, I think he was handed an impossible situation and then was a fall guy, and that's the reason why he's out. You know, it wasn't like he had gone out and turned in four really, really depressing campaigns with talented teams that should have been better. I think he kind of got jobbed at the end there. So
it really does
seem like it's all systems go.
The mouthfeel of that sandwich that he was handed was not great.
Ew.
Mouthfeel.
Gross.
I love when people were talking about, like, I was watching Anthony Bourdain before I got on the podcast today. He's like, oh, yeah, tripe. It's such a great meat. Like, you know, it smells like death and it smells like shit. But, like, you have to separate yourself from that. I'm like, if I get served a plate of tripe and it smells like shit, I'm not going to eat that. That is something I'm not going to eat because it smells like shit. You don't want that.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's
well,
true.
Like, why would you want to eat that? Oh, it's a delicacy. Really? Where?
Yeah.
Can you bread this in cornflakes for me? I just please
and fry it up yeah. Nice. Yeah, no, it's it all sounds gross.
It all sounds totally super gross.
All sounds terrible, like pretty much everything about society. We don't have any Ask PDPs in, so we'll roll with that for
we have been absent fathers with the PDP.
Yeah,
let's be perfectly honest.
We've been pretty bad lately. But this was a very good hour to have today. So I'm happy with that. And I think that will probably bring us just to about an end. You got anything else? I don't have anything else.
This is going to be a big picture conversation, but I feel about, you know, somewhat of the election, but it really does feel like the biggest thing here, because everybody was so convinced on either side that their person was going to win. And I think it really just does magnify how easy it is to insulate yourself anymore, you know, because on Twitter, on social media especially, you can block people, you can mute people who annoy you or who don't think the way that you do. And when that happens, you insulate yourself the way that you do. It really takes the level of discourse to a new low, in my opinion. So if, you know, if we don't agree on things, on certain situations, on big picture matters, on Rockies matters, I've been quick to hit mute buttons on people that, you know, don't usually tweet into us. And if they say something stupid, I'm like, screw you, whatever. This is kind of a wake up call, I think, for a lot of people. If you surround yourself with only people who tell you the same things that you believe in, the things you want to hear, that's not a good way to have a solid level of discourse in any situation, whether it's politics, whether it's sports and anything. So that's going to be my little rant on it, that it's easy to surround yourself with people who think just like you, but that's not necessarily the best way to go through life all the time. Obviously you don't want to deal with eggs on like Twitter all day. That there's no point in that. And some people are just miserable, miserable human beings, and you can cut them out at some point if necessary. But this is a huge moment for America, good or bad. You know, hopefully we can move forward from it. But I think that was the biggest takeaway I had from it last night, was that I was realizing I was so, so insulated, because you're always on social media, especially with my job. You always kind of have to be, you know, where I live. I live in Los Angeles. I live with, you know, somewhat like-minded people. And I realized how disconnected I was from reality last night, from like the reality of the United States. I think that was the biggest thing for me. So going forward this year, I will really try to be more open-minded with everybody's opinion, not just people who think the same way I do. And I hope that everybody else can be more civilized than we have been for the last 2 years, because this last 2 years of politics has been the most miserable in my existence.
You know, and I'm open-minded with the reason the Rockies are bad is because the fans keep going to games.
Yeah.
Copyright 2016, Mark Kisla.
Fans keep going to games. Therefore, the Rockies are trash.
The Colorado Rockies story by Mark Kisla. That's my open-minded thought. Wake up, sheeple. It's your fault. It's your fault. The Rockies are bad. Rockies are bad because you care too much.
Yeah, that must be it.
By the way, a Twitter account that you all should be following if you are not is @MinersTeamNames, which is run by the phenomenal voice of the AAA El Paso Chihuahuas in the San Diego Padres organization, Tim Haggerty. And Tim Haggerty just tweeted this, quote, William Howard Taft presented the Denver Grizzlies a trophy in 1911, believed to be the first time a sitting president went to a minor league game. I never knew that.
How about that?
That's incredible. I never knew that. Huh. And now we know. Dun, 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 dun. Now you know the rest of the story.
Of the story.
All right.
So, yeah, well, hopefully we'll have another podcast coming up.
Yeah, where are you going?
Before the winter meetings. So, Long Beach State has a massive road trip coming up. So, if you didn't hear, I will be doing Game Breaks live on FS1 this Saturday. They'll be sending it back to Anthony Masterson in the studio. Which is the first time going to be on air, not like showing my face, but at least voicing stuff during bunch of games on Saturday, including the CU Arizona game. So that's gonna be the last one of the night. So I'm sure a lot of you will be listening or watching that game. And then Long Beach State goes on it's like an NBA road trip. It's a 7 games in 12 days and 8 games in 16 days. So, and it takes us to Wichita State, North Carolina, Louisville, back to UCLA. So we're home for like a day and a half. And then we fly up to Washington to play the Huskies. Then on the day before Thanksgiving, we then fly from Seattle to Newark and all the way down to Fort Myers, Florida for the Battle for Atlantis over Thanksgiving. That'll be the Battle for Atlantis mainland hosted by Florida Gulf Coast University. Play 2 games there. Then I think we come back for some reason for a couple of days. And then on the 29th of November, we fly to Kansas to play the Jayhawks.
Huh.
And then we're back for a week.
Enjoy
and
that.
Then we go to Austin to play the Longhorns. Then we end up playing Oregon State at the Rose Garden in Portland, which will be fun. And also at New Mexico State as well.
That is a haul.
At Eastern Michigan, too, a couple days before New Year's. As well, so that Long Beach State, they pride themselves on having the best non-conference schedule of any team in the country, and they're going to have number one for the second consecutive year, more than likely. I mean, that's just a haul right there. That's 3 top 16 teams in the first 4 games that they're going to be playing, including 2 top 10s. So.
That sounds exhausting.
Yeah, huh. Especially after being on the road for 3 straight weeks.
Yeah,
yeah, with the World Series. Yeah, I'm
holy smokes.
Yeah, It's fun because you get to broadcast in all those kind of places. You know, I got to go to Duke last year and Arizona and Oregon and all those places. But, man, it's a haul. Especially a road trip like this for a college team is somewhat unheard of because you're playing game, travel day for basically 3 weeks.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah. So are you saying that we may not get to do our Thanksgiving pie spectacular with Craig Goldstein?
I will be back for a couple of days if we can work it out with Craig.
Okay.
Because because if we can do that, I don't want to have like a pie gazi on my hands.
Yeah. No. See, those jokes aren't even funny anymore. Now it's just depressing. What a world.
I thought pie gazi.
No, that was pretty good. That was pretty good. That was pretty good actually. Better than pie gate. I'm glad that we've moved past gate for everything.
Just add Gazi to everything.
We've added something new.
Yeah.
Well, then let's make that happen. We'll break down pies and we'll try to remember the good things in the world. And hopefully this podcast is one of those things for you guys as we put the finishing touches on episode number 90 of the Purple Dinosaur podcast.
Goddamn.
Yeah, crazy. 90 episodes. 10 more to 100. If we make it that far,
we'll probably hit that like in next August at this rate.
At this rate, we'll make it there at some point in 2017. 2017 is gonna suck. Let's hope the Rockies are good. That would really
except help. For my wedding and stuff, Dick.
Well, if I can make it, I guess I'll be there. Yeah. All right. Enjoy the trip, buddy.
Will too. Yeah.
We'll talk to you next time. Pre-Thanksgiving. Right. We'll talk to you all that time as well. Thanks for tuning into the PDP. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.